the connection between three physical concepts that look very different. They are entanglement, gravity, and quantum error correction. And I'll explain each of them in detail later on. But I think the thing that I want to keep in mind is that there are this connection between the three of them. I want to see how they help us understand each of these ideas better. So let me start by noticing a common theme in how we understand physics, on how we make breakthroughs. It's by focusing on the most surprising part of a theory. And these are a few examples which we all know about and understand. But quantum gravity is something that we don't currently have a complete understanding about. We can ask, what is the most surprising thing about quantum gravity? I would say the most surprising thing about quantum gravity is the fact that entropy in the theory of quantum gravity is given by some area. It satisfies an area law. Let me give an example of how this works. This goes back to a story that was perhaps one of the most profound discoveries in quantum gravity, which is the story that black holes carry entropy, and the amount of that entropy is given by a quarter of the horizon area in Planck units. And this formula, which was first discovered by Bekenstein and Hawking, is a fantastic formula in the sense that it incorporates essentially all areas of modern physics. It also led to a lot of progress in actually understanding the theory, the quantum gravity. For example, it inspired the holographic principle. The holographic principle is the statement that we should think of a theory of quantum gravity as encoding all its degrees of freedom, the fundamental ones, on the boundary of space-time. To make that very concrete, the story wasn't very concrete until about 18 years ago with the discovery of the ADS-CFT correspondence. The ADS-CFT correspondence is a statement that if we look at quantum gravity in a space-time known as antisocial space-time, it's a simplest space-time with negative cosmological constant, it's dual to or equivalent to a certain set of CFTs, conformal field theories, living on the boundary of that space-time. I want to emphasize that this correspondence is our best understood and most concrete example of quantum gravity. It illustrates how gravitational physics can be emergent, can emerge from a non-gravitational theory when the non-gravitational theory is strongly coupled. So it's a very concrete example. We don't completely understand every aspect of this duality, and it would be nice to get a better understanding of this. So for example, if we could understand how this works, we could generalize it, conceivably generalize it to other background like cosmology, which is really what we are interested in. So we currently don't have any concrete framework for understanding cosmology in a non-perturbative way with gravity. Of course, this also is a nice framework for generalizing the area law beyond the case of black hole horizon. But in order to say that, I have to first introduce the concept of quantum entanglement. It's simply the correlation between two different subsystems. When we have a Hilbert space, we can divide it into a tensor factor of A and B, and there generally are correlations between them. The simplest example of such entanglement is probably just given by a pair of spins up and down, and they're anti-correlated, so this is an entangled state. In general, we would like to measure, we would like to get a good hold on how to describe entanglements between different parts of the system. So this is given by the entanglement entropy. It's a measure of how much entanglement there is between different parts of a system. The definition of the entanglement entropy involves taking the density matrix, which is what we get when we trace out, when we forget part of a system. For example, for the case of two spins, we can forget about one spin and we look at the other spin. then the density matrix is a diagonal matrix with off that with eigenvalues 1/2. And if we take the trace of rho log rho for this density matrix, this is the von Neumann entropy, and we get the entanglement entropy for between the two spins, and for this case, it's log 2. Of course, for large Hilbert space, for more complicated systems, the Hilbert space can get really, really big, and in general, this is a very complicated quantity, even just by its definition. If we have 200 spins, then we have a huge density matrix of order 2 to the 400 matrix elements. And it's generally it's fairly complicated to deal with such situations. The question is, is there any way that we can simplify this complicated quantity? Can we describe it in another way? This is where holography comes in. So in the holographic context, if we describe, let's say, a conformal field theory that has a holographic dual in the context that I mentioned earlier, then there was a proposal by Ruan Takayanagi in 2006 that entanglement entropy is dramatically simplified in this context. Instead of solving for trace of a huge matrix, a log of a huge matrix, what you need to do is, instead of solving that problem, you simply solve for a minimal surface area in the dual space-time. And the minimal surface here is this green line. So I'm drawing a picture where I've reduced the dimension of the theory of the boundary conformal field theory to two dimensions, just to, in order for me to draw a picture. Then the region I'm talking about is this red interval, A. The entanglement entropy for A, in this case, is given by a minimal surface or geodesic in the bulk. And in general dimensions, it's always going to be an area of some minimal surface, which is codimension 2 in the bulk. And the minimal surface is supposed to be anchored at the boundary of A. So it's anchored at edge of A, and we minimize the surface area. This is a very nice prescription. It essentially converts an almost impossible calculation in strongly coupled theories into a very doable one, which involves just solving for some ODE or PDEs in the bulk. But I think another way that I think this is, to demonstrate this, how much of a simplification is, perhaps I should mention that in general, the entanglement entropy is fairly complicated, even for free theories. If we take the simplest free theories that we can think of, perhaps 1+1-dimensional free massless boson theories. That's a very simple theory. And if we take that theory and talk about, instead of talking about one interval, let me talk about the union of two intervals. The statement is that it has not been completely worked out what the entanglement entropy for the union of two intervals is in such a simple theory. Not in closed form. One can numerically solve it, but not there is no current analytic form for such a formula when the massless boson has a general radius. So in that sense, it's generally very complicated. But here we can do it in a very simple way. But I want to emphasize that there is another sense where I think this prescription is very interesting. It's that it appears if we know all these minimal, if we know the entanglement entropy for all regions. Suppose we put the theory on a computer and solve, and it gives us back the numbers for all the entanglement entropies for every region that I can think of in the CFT. Then I can go back and reconstruct the metric. I simply need to find the metric for which the minimal surfaces for all these minimal surfaces matches the output of the computer that computes the entanglement entropy for me. And that would be a procedure where I can imagine building on and eventually find a derivation of the ADS-CFT correspondence. So that would be very interesting. But now I'm going to say that all of this beautiful story is really only the tip of the iceberg. There is a huge generalization of all of this, everything on this slide. And that's the generalization from entanglement to Rényi entropies. Let me define Rényi entropies in a moment and just say that for now it's some other entropy that one can consider for regions, subregions in the quantum field theory. So the statement is the Rényi entropy, or some derivative of this of the Rényi entropy, is also given by some area in the dual spacetime. It's given by the area of a cosmic brain in the dual spacetime, and I'll explain that, give a precise definition of that on the next slide. So the quick way of saying all of this is that the gravity dual Rényi entropy, whereas the gravity dual of the entanglement entropy is a minimal surface, the gravity dual of Rényi entropies is a cosmic brain. So let me explain what that means. Let me first explain the left-hand side. So Rényi entropy is this entropy with an index with a subscript at n, and it's defined as a function of m by trace rho to the log trace rho to the n, where rho, again, is the density matrix. For example, if rho is a diagonal matrix, this is simply powers of the sums of powers of the eigenvalue before we take the log. It's a one-parameter generalization of the von Neumann entropy. If we take the parameter n to 1, then this whole thing becomes the von Neumann entropy. So it becomes what we were discussing before. But I want to emphasize that this is a family of measures of entanglement that contain much more information about the state than simply the von Neumann entropy. One way to see this is that the von Neumann entropy is just one number. It doesn't tell us a lot about what's the structure of entanglement between different regions of the theory. Whereas if we know the Rényi entropies for all values of integer n, if we know, suppose we can compute this for n equals 2, n equals 3, and so on, then we can, in principle, reconstruct the entanglement spectrum. And entanglement spectrum means the spectrum of eigenvalues of the density matrix. So that contains really a lot of information about the state. And also, Rényi entropies are useful because they are more, at least for integer values of n, they are more experimentally measurable. So recently there has been experiments in which you can create a double copy of a system where then you perform some measurement on the double copy and that measures the second Rényi entropy, which is this S2 where n equals 2. It's also easier to solve numerically. And this is really just because at integer values of n, the Rényi entropy can be written as a partition function. And partition functions are or expectation value of some operators. So they are easier to study. Whereas the von Neumann entropy involves log of the density matrix, which is almost impossible to directly measure in an experiment. But still, this quantity is complicated if we want to study strongly coupled systems. We don't really have a very good way of studying such quantities, and especially when the system is large, then we don't really know how to do. But the prescription is that we can convert this again into a very simple calculation. The simple calculation now involves cosmic brains, and cosmic brain is a similar thing. It's very similar to minimal surfaces. They are both codimension 2 in the bulk. So if we, for the simple case of having a three-dimensional bulk geometry, they're both one-dimensional. So the minimal surface would be a geodesic, and cosmic brains are usually called cosmic strings in this context. And both of them are, the cosmic brain is also anchored at the edge of the region that we're interested in. So we can draw exactly the same picture. At least topologically, this is the right picture. The difference is that the cosmic brain has non-zero tension, so it back reacts on the geometry, whereas a minimal surface doesn't do anything on the ambient geometry. This is the only difference that the cosmic brain has about compared to the minimal surface. The tension of the cosmic brain is given as a function of n, and it's the Rayleigh index in this way. And it back to the back reaction, because it's codimension two, the back reaction is very simple. It creates a conical deficit angle proportional to the tension. So a useful way that I think of getting the geometry or thinking about how to get the geometry is simply make a system that contains both Einstein-Hilbert action, so Einstein gravity in the bulk, and adding the brain and solve the equation of motion to this total action. The brain will back react and finds its right position and so on. So this provides a full solution to the system at any value of n. If we take the n goes to one limit, then this tension goes to zero. If the tension goes to zero, that means the brain has become a probe object. It will stop back reacting on the geometry and will settle at a minimal surface. And in this way, you can also check that as n goes to one, the left-hand side here also has to become the von Neumann entropy. So in this sense, both sides of this equation becomes what we have already seen, which is the Rutaki-Nagy formula for the von Neumann entropy. So that's a sanity check for this equation. But here I'm claiming that this equation holds for arbitrary values of n. So this is a one parameter generalization. You can ask, why does this work? How do I think about it intuitively? You can even ask, why do we have such a complicated derivative of the Rayleigh entropy on the left-hand side of the equation? Well, I want to propose that the left-hand side it's only complicated because I want to write it as a conventional, in terms of conventional Rayleigh entropy. I want to say it's even a more natural candidate than the standard Rayleigh entropy for generalizing the von Neumann entropy. So let me define this whole left-hand side as, just write it as tilde. If we plug in the definition of the Rayleigh entropy, we will get an expression that involves log of trace of the density matrix to the nth power. Now we can rewrite this thing as a standard thermodynamic relation. And that's why this S tilde is a more natural entropy. The way to rewrite this is to observe that the trace rho to the n is actually just the partition function of the system with some modular Hamiltonian, with some Hamiltonian as its at a given temperature. So trace rho to the n is a partition function if we set the temperature to be 1 over n and the Hamiltonian to be the modular Hamiltonian. And then we can rewrite everything in the parentheses as the free energy, and S tilde is the derivative of the free energy with respect to the temperature. In general, S tilde has to be non-negative. This is true for any thermodynamic entropy. And it is actually true this is true as a general statement about Rayleigh entropies. Now, because it's given by an area, it is automatically true in the theory of quantum gravity. I want to also emphasize that this equation, I've explained how intuitively it works, but actually there's a derivation for this. The derivation has several ingredients, so I'm going to not repeat all the parts of the derivation. But the ingredients involves, first, we want to do the replica trick, which is really the statement that we can understand the Rayleigh entropies for integer values of n as partition functions of the theory on the particular manifold. This is this is all happening at this stage. Yes? Yes, I should probably have said that. Thank you for reminding me. The reason is that I want to convey the idea that in general we expect anything that is should properly be called an entropy be precisely given by some area in the theory of quantum gravity. As a general principle. Entanglement entropy, black hole entropies are examples of this. Now I'm saying that there is a one parameter family of quantities which are more naturally called entropies, and they are also precisely given by area, by the area of something. So in this sense, I'm trying to explain why it is this derivative with respect to n that is given precisely by the area of the cosmic brain rather than as n itself. So this is why I want to say that this S n tilde, which is the left-hand side of this equation, that should be thought of as a more natural candidate of an entropy, whereas S n, the standard Rayleigh entropy, should be thought of as more of an analog of a free energy. Because they are derived strictly, they are derived in a simple way from partition functions.
Yeah.
Thank you. So as I was saying earlier, the ingredients used in deriving this equation involves the replica trick, which happens purely in the CFT. It's just a statement that we can find Rayleigh entropies for integer values of n as partition functions on a replicated manifold. So here, the picture is supposed to mean that if we have the CFT living on a plane, and then the region that I'm interested in is this interval, then I should make n copies of the plane and glue them together across this cut. So for the interval, I cut them at each copy, and then I glue them together in a cyclic way. So this will construct what is known as the n-fold branched cover for the manifold, and the partition function is directly related to the Rayleigh entropy. Now, since this is a partition function, this is an ideal object for studying in holographic context. The ADS-CFT correspondence simply translate that into a bulk correlation function, a bulk partition function, a partition function that we can evaluate on the gravitational side. We can use even WKB approximation and simply evaluate the on-shell action as a first order approximation to the partition function on the gravitational side. Yes? In this case, the bulk is built to be whatever manifold that satisfies the equation of motion with this as a boundary condition. You can alternatively, so that is already a definition of what the bulk is, but you could, if you really want, you could start from the bulk corresponds to a single copy of the geometry and then replicate it. But then you have to make sure that you solve all equations of motion after replicating it. So what has to happen is when you replicate the, that's an equivalent definition. But in that definition, I want to emphasize that the subtle thing is after you replicate the bulk, you have to make sure that the conical excess that you get when you replicate the bulk is smoothened away by solving the equation of motion. So maybe I should say that topologically it's the same manifold as what you would get by replicating the bulk, but you have to really to solve all equations of motion. Does that answer your question?
Maybe I can follow up. So there is no conical singularity in the bulk.
That's right.
It only develops as you approach the boundary.
It only approaches as you approach the boundary. That's correct. That's the bulk geometry that I'm talking now. In a moment, I'm going to make some singularity, but that's something I'm going to do in a moment. So right now, the bulk is simply whatever smooth geometry that asymptotes to this boundary. Now I'm going to do something rather non-trivial. This actually is a trick that was used by Lukoich and Malacena in proving the Ruta-Kanagi formula in the case of the von Neumann entropy. So what they proposed is to notice that there is a Zn symmetry that cyclically permutes the n copies on a boundary. It's just a symmetry of the boundary manifold. The question is, does this Z-n symmetry persist all the way into the bulk geometry? And let's work under the assumption that the Z-n symmetry does extend into the bulk geometry. This is a statement that the Z-n symmetry is not spontaneously broken. Why do I say that it is not spontaneously broken? Well, here we have a Lagrangian defined. We can imagine writing down some theory of the CFT on this manifold. At some level, the Lagrangian has the symmetry. If the bulk solution also have the symmetry, then this is the usual sense that we say that the symmetry is not spontaneously broken. So let's work under that assumption. There's been no counterexample to that assumption, and I think it's a very interesting question to further check whether there are such examples. But now, under that assumption, I can take a quotient, the bulk geometry with the Z-n symmetry. What that will do is it will give a smooth manifold everywhere, it will give a manifold that is smooth everywhere except at the fixed points of the Z-n symmetry. The fixed points of the Z-n symmetry, of course, will have a conical deficit after I take a quotient. We can figure out where they are simply by looking at maybe at the boundary. At the boundary, what appears is that if I ask what is the fixed point of the Z-n symmetry, that's the boundary of the region A that I'm computing entanglement for, entropy or Rényi entropies for. So the fixed points in the bulk must be something that extends to the fixed point on the boundary. And a more careful analysis shows that I should have a picture that is essentially the same as what I mentioned before. There is a codimension 2 fixed line, and the codimension 2 fixed line extend all the way to the asymptotically approaches the boundary of the region A on the CFT side. The intuitive picture of all of this, if that's too complicated, the intuitive picture is imagine cutting a pizza. So the pizza is completely smooth. That's supposed to be the geometry dual to this replicated geometry on the boundary. But once I take a quotient with respect to some Z-n symmetry, I will get one piece of the pizza which has a conical deficit at the center. The center is the fixed point of the Z-n symmetry. Now, once I look at a single piece, it is very obvious that I can analytically continue in N. Because N is really just the angle. N is completely characterized by the angle or deficit angle of each of the fundamental region or each piece of the pizza. And now it's something that I can continuously tune. Once I continuously tune each piece of the pizza, it's not something that then I can get by the Z-n quotient of something, because n is no longer an integer. But each piece makes sense even when n is not an integer. And that's the thing that that nicely gives the picture that I have. Each piece is supposed to be this geometry with a cosmic brain, with a conical deficit. The question now becomes a classical mechanics problem, because in the leading approximation in the bulk, all I need to evaluate is the on-shell action of a gravitational theory, plus perhaps matter Lagrangians. And the question really is, what's the variation? So this variation with respect to n is really just a variation of the on-shell action with respect to changing of the boundary condition, where just infinitesimally tuning the angle, the deficit angle near the conical deficit, and that is in classical mechanics, that's always given by a boundary term. Evaluating the boundary term will give an area, so that gives the area law. So that's the outline of the derivation for this formula. Yes?
For integer n, is it you know, is it technically really more advantageous to take this Zn quotient, or is it basically the same thing?
So the Zn quotient, obvious, you can, maybe you're asking whether the Zn quotient has the same action as the action of the parent space divided by n. And that's true. That's by definition true, yes. In fact, that's how we pass from the on-shell action for the parent space to the on-shell action for the quotient. It's just related by 1 over n. Any other questions? If not, then I'll talk about a simple example where this can be used, where this area load can be completely applied to an actual example. This is a calculation of Rényi entropies for two spherical disks in a holographic CFT. I've drawn a picture in 1+1 dimensions, but you can imagine in your mind a higher dimensional disk. And the reason I want to consider two disks is that for the case of one spherical disk in a holographic CFT, the Rényi entropy was elegantly calculated by using a symmetry by Rob here and collaborators. What they found is that they can transform, using the symmetry, they can transform the problem into a problem of finding hyperbolic black hole solutions. And then the Rényi entropy is simply related to the entropy of the black hole, which is then computed by the area of the horizon. Now, the prescription here can be applied for arbitrary regions, not just spherical regions. So it goes beyond the spherical case, because it now can apply to any situation, even without a symmetry. The simplest case is when we have two disks. And in this case, we can easily study what is known as the mutual Rényi information defined by this combination of Rényi entropies. This quantity is nice because the Rényi entropy itself is ultraviolet divergent, just because there are infinitely many entangled pairs across the entangling surface at a very, very short distance. This is true for any for any quantum field theory. And this combination has the nice thing that it gets rid of all the divergences. So it's regulator independent and finite. There are two phases for this calculation that depends, which really depends on how far and what size the two intervals are away from each other. We're going to focus on the large distance phase where the dominant contribution comes from a cosmic string or cosmic brain wrapping or ending on each one of the two disks. So that's the context in which we're doing the calculation. If the distance is too small, at some point, the cosmic brain will want to go to another configuration. And that the other configuration is that in this picture, it will be joining x1 with x4 and joining x2 with x3. But for now, we're going to stay in a large distance phase. In this phase, the mutual information, which is the value that you get at n equals 1, is actually vanishing because by the Ruta-Kanagi prescription, we just have two minimal surfaces. And they don't talk with each other, so they the area completely cancel out in the definition of mutual information. But generally, the mutual Rényi information is non-zero. So in this sense, it's already non-trivial that we are getting actually something about the structure of entanglement from the Rényi entropies. The mutual Rényi information is non-zero because the two cosmic brains talk with each other. So one see the presence of each other, and that's why one of them will change the area of the other one. We can solve for the back reaction in a perturbative way. The problem is well defined for even when the back reaction is finite. Because the back reaction goes like n minus 1. So even if we are finitely away from n equals 1, we could approach this problem numerically. But to get some analytically nice formula, I had to work perturbatively in minus one, and the expression that I got is the following. It seems complicated, but let me just explain what the important things are. X is the cross ratio that is one can define from the four points. If we go to higher dimensions, then we have four, then we have two spherical disks. Then we can draw a line connecting the center of the four of the two disks. It intersects with the two disks at four points. We can use the same four points to define cross ratio. So that's what appears in the expression. And CT is supposed to be a central charge that appears in the two-point function of the stress tensor. This expression applies for any dimensions, but it's nice to also see that if you plug in d equals 2, then it agrees actually with two-dimensional calculations that already exist in the literature, where in two dimensions you have the additional power of using conformal block techniques to calculate this in the strongly coupled regime. So it's nice to see that everything matches. Yes?
Does it use like large central charge?
Yes. Yes, so the idea is that you can calculate a four-point function of a twist operator in two dimensions, and you can write it as an OPE expansion. And at large central charge and sparse with a sparse spectrum assumption for the CFT, you conclude that the only contribution at large central charge to this four-point function comes from the vacuum conformal block. And that's the contribution from the vacuum conformal block that matches this formula. I want to also mention just very quickly a story about shape dependence of the Rényi entropy. The Rényi entropy in four dimension, for this part, I'm going to just talk about four-dimensional CFTs. In four-dimensional CFTs, the Rényi entropy has a universal part, which is so first there is an area part which goes quadratically with the ultraviolet cutoff of the theory. That's just because there are many entangled pairs across the entangling surface, and the number of them goes like the UV cutoff. But there is also a term which goes like log of the UV cutoff. And the coefficient of that term is universal in the sense that it is not scheme dependent. So you can calculate it in any regulator that you like. In 4D, the coefficient can be written in terms of sums of conformal invariants that you build out of the surface. So for a spherical shape, if we have a spherical shape for the region, then all that we're going to get is this first term, which involves the integral of the intrinsic Ricci scalar on the surface. The sigma is supposed to be in the entangling surface. In general, if you consider a shape, a deformed sphere, in general, you can do a finite deformation. It doesn't have to be a small deformation. Then you can get other contributions to the universal coefficient. One of them comes from the traceless part of the extrinsic curvature squared, and the other third term comes from the Weyl tensor appropriately projected to orthogonal directions to the surface and contracted. So these are three conformal invariants one can write down, and we also know from Soderdukin's formula that if we set n to 1 for von Neumann entropy, then the coefficient of these three conformal invariants are very simply determined from the central charges of the CFT. So FA is equal to A and FB, FC are equal to C in this special case. There was a conjecture made about 2 years ago about the coefficient FB and FC for arbitrary n. The claim is that they're always equal, not just at n equals 1. The conjecture was partly based on observations that this is true in free field theories for free scalars and what they computed to be free fermions and so on in four dimensions. And it has been studied, this conjecture has been studied afterwards, and I actually spent quite a lot of time trying to prove the conjecture, hoping that it is a true statement for arbitrary CFTs in four dimensions. But unfortunately, it is actually not a true statement in four-dimensional CFTs. Actually, I was able to do a holographic calculation, and there already one can see some difference between the two functions. So I'm not going to say the details about the holographic calculation. It's fairly standard calculation. And if we plot FBFC as a function of the Rainy index, the difference is fairly small if you look at it on this plot, but the difference is non-zero. It is precisely zero at n equals one, as it has to be, but in general, it's non-zero. And one can also this comes from a numerical OPE calculation. One can also do analytic calculations perturbatively at n equals one, so that already shows a difference between FV and FC to first order in n minus one. So up to now, I've mostly focused on using the area law for entanglement or Rainy entropies to understand the structure of quantum entanglement for various states in the system, and maybe to efficiently calculate Rainy entropies. I want to do something else in the rest of the talk. I want to use all what we have learned so far to improve our understanding of quantum gravity. And in some sense, I think that would be extremely interesting, and perhaps even more interesting than just computing Rainy entropies. But in order to motivate the question, I would like to take a step back. So I would like to go back to this slide, which I had at the beginning, about ADS CFT. There's a number of things that we know between the two sides of the duality that match with each other. One of them, which I didn't quite explain, was that because this is a duality of two different theories, we should generally expect that if we can map state and operators from one theory, or state and operators in one theory, to the other side. That has to be true because the Hilbert space between the two sides are supposed to be isomorphic. Now, we know part of the answer to how to do this map. If we want to get a local operator in the CFT, we can simply take a bulk operator phi and take the limit that it goes to the boundary. So this extrapolation of bulk operator is supposed to give the boundary operator. But this doesn't really tell us how to back away from the limit and ask the how to answer the question, what is the bulk operator from the CFT language? This problem is called the reconstruction of the bulk, because suppose we know how to do this for any bulk operator, then we can really derive all the gravitational, in principle, we can derive all the gravitational physics that we want to understand by if we can solve the CFT. And in principle, we maybe can be technically difficult, but the CFT itself is well-defined. So in that sense, we can achieve at least conceptually complete understanding of gravity if we know the answer to this question. The answer to this there's one answer to this question which is already known. This was worked out by Hamilton, Cabot, Lifshitz, and Lowe. Their answer to the question is, if you want to ask what is the bulk operator, for example, sitting here, and the picture here is I've drawn anti-de-Sitter space as a cylinder, so the field theory lives on the cylinder and the bulk is inside. Phi in the bulk can be written as a linear combination of local operators in the CFT. And the coefficient of this linear combination is usually known as a smearing function. It can be explicitly solved. I haven't written it down here, but it can be explicitly solved by solving the bulk equation of motion with certain boundary conditions. So this roughly gives an idea of what bulk operators are. And it's also important that here I'm doing the global patch of anti-de-Sitter space, and the support of K is in this green region. the green region is defined in the following way. Take all the points that is not time-like with respect to x, the bulk point that we want to study, and that's the region that has support for the smearing function. In other words, if you know everything about operators in this green patch in the CFT, then you can completely reconstruct the bulk operator. Now, you might think, perhaps we can do better. Perhaps we can know less information about the CFT and still be able to reconstruct the operator. And that's also true. You can essentially generalize the previous slide into a situation where K, the smearing function, has a smaller support. The smaller support has to do with the following. Again, take the cylinder, but now on this time slice, let me choose only a region, in this case, just one interval A, and it will, on the boundary, it will have a domain of dependence, which is a causal diamond on the boundary. We can achieve the same bulk operator with a smearing function that has support only on this smaller green region, the causal diamond, as long as the following condition is satisfied. The condition is that the bulk operator cannot be too far from A. How far is too far? There is a boundary that we can set by considering the minimal surface that corresponds to the region A. So that's the same minimal surface that we use to determine the entanglement entropy. But here, the minimal surface plays the role of the division between the space where we can construct from purely information on A and region of the spacetime that cannot be reconstructed in this way. So in this way, we say that if we have all the information that we know about the CFT on the subregion A, we then know the entire, what is known as the ADS-Ringler wedge of the bulk spacetime. So this entire blue region. This has been only explicitly worked out when A is an interval in the 1 plus 1 dimensional CFT, or in higher dimensions, A needs to be a spherical disk for this case. So one can now ask the following question. If we have a general subregion with arbitrary shapes, not just spherical shapes in the CFT, what part of the bulk spacetime does it capture? The reason why this is interesting is if we can understand the various ways that we can capture the same information, then it will be a very useful step in actually understanding how the bulk spacetime emerges from a CFT. So what's the answer to this question? There is a conjecture. I'm going to first say what the conjecture answer is and then provide a proof. The conjecture to the answer of this question is that involves the notion of the entanglement wedge. The entanglement wedge is the region of the spacetime that is bounded always by the Rutta-Kyanagi minimal surface. That's the definition. So that's true even when we have a non-spherical region. Let me give an example of how this works. The entanglement wedge has some non-trivial feature. If we consider the region to be the union of two intervals in a CFT, the CFT now lives on a circle. So this is a time slice of the CFT at a particular time. Each of the interval happens to be small, in this picture smaller than one quarter of the system, then the minimal surface are represented by the dotted line, by the solid lines here, and the entanglement wedge is simply the blue region. It's disconnected. However, if we increase the size to a little more than a quarter of the total system, then the minimal surface suddenly jumps to these two solid lines, and the entanglement wedge suddenly becomes much larger. and now contains the center of the space. Now the entanglement wedge conjecture says any operator, no matter which configuration we're sitting at, any point in this blue region in the entanglement wedge can be reconstructed as operators in the CFT that has support only on the region A. Why is it, sorry? Because the transition, so here you essentially compare whether this, you have two extremal surfaces that ends on the boundary of the region A. One is, for example, look at this picture. You can either have a union of this geodesic with this geodesic, or you can have the dotted ones. Now you compare which one of them are the true minimal surface. So the quarter, here A is a union of two intervals. When each interval is a quarter of the size of the circle, then that's when you have a phase transition. That's when the total length of the solid geodesic is the same as the dotted one. That's essentially a symmetry. You can essentially do it by a symmetry argument. When each of them is at a quarter size, there's a symmetry between A and A complement.
I was going to ask about the conjecture when they're both equal.
Yes. When we get very, very close, extremely close to that phase transition, I think the statement is that we can only concretely say things when we are not very, very close to the phase transition. In the following sense, where every discussion here involves taking working in perturbatively in some one over the central charge expansion of the CFT. So when we get too close to that to the phase transition, then I think the conservative statement is always to stay on the smaller side. I believe that in order to really construct the inside of the center of the space-time, one needs to be reasonably far from the phase transition. So why this might be interesting is there is a way to think about this problem as going beyond the horizon. I didn't say it, but the dotted lines can be thought of as the causal horizon that corresponds to the region A. It's if you think about this adding time into the picture, then this dotted line is really the causal horizon. And if we can represent operators at the center, that's really going beyond the horizon. Here I've just given one example. There are more examples where you can see that it's actually going beyond the standard black hole horizon. So I'm going to just quickly mention the ingredients for proving the conjecture. One ingredient is the fact that we should think about holography as really as a quantum error correcting code. And the second thing is the statement that was recently proved that the CFT relative entropy is the bulk relative entropy. For the sake of time, I'm going to say probably not going to the details, but I'm going to give one real the most punchline for why we should think of the holography as a quantum error correcting code. I mentioned the ADS Ringler reconstruction, which already tells us there are many, many ways of reconstructing the same operator. And they are not all the same. For example, if I look at this CFT living on a circle, I can divide it into three equal parts and call them A, B, and C. Now the centered operator can be represented according to the rules that I have said before, as an operator both on A, either on AB or an operator on BC or an operator on AC. In the standard CFT, this is impossible if I think of it as the statement as an operator statement. So the resolution of that puzzle is that this is actually not an operator statement. We shouldn't think that the same bulk operator can be represented by the same CFT operator that can be written in three different ways. That's impossible. We should think that the same bulk operator can be effectively represented by three different CFT operators. But why can we think about the same bulk operator as three different CFT operators? Because they all act in the same way on some privileged subspace of the Hilbert space of the CFT. That subspace happens to be the semi-classical space of states that we usually consider when studying the bulk perturbatively. But this is precisely what happens for quantum error correction. We want to, just as a picture, in a quantum error correction story, we have one, let's say we have one qubit. Then we want to build in some redundancy by encoding the information in a non-local way among three qubits. Then what happens is I can lose one of the three qubits and still be able to recover the information. Of course, in this example, we actually have qubits instead of qubits, but let me still use the language of qubits. It is clear from this example that we can perform, there is a privileged set of states there is a larger Hilbert space for three qubits, but there is a privileged subspace which represents useful information. That's the subspace that actually encodes information of the one qubit. And the way that the code works is that I can realize the same logical operation on that one qubit by performing the operation in many, many different ways, because I can essentially lose any one of the three and still be able to perform the operation on the other two. So that mimics the features that we've seen on the previous slide about ADS-CFT. Now, in holography, the code subspace simply contains bulk states. So I won't have time to go through all of the area, quantum corrections to the area law, but let me just mention that what I previously said about the area law for Rényi entropies can be improved to have quantum corrections in the bulk, and that is another way of deriving a statement in ADS-CFT. That's the statement that we should think of the modular Hamiltonian in the CFT as being very related to the modular Hamiltonian in the bulk. The modular Hamiltonian is defined simply as log of the density matrix. From that, a number of people, Jefferies, Lukowicz, Molisena, and Su, was able to derive a surprising fact about relative entropy between the two sides of the duality. It's a statement that if we choose two states that have classically the same geometry but maybe different quantum mechanically, then the relative entropy, which is the description of how far the two states are in the Hilbert space, are the same no matter whether you evaluate the distance in evaluate the relative entropy in the bulk or evaluate it in the CFT. So the statement is, if that's true, which we know from fairly standard bulk analysis, then we can actually prove a theorem that says any bulk operator in the entanglement wedge must be able to be reconstructed as a CFT operator on the boundary subregion. I'm going to skip this proof, it should be fairly straightforward if you think about what relative entropy means, but there's a way to make everything very, very precise. So feel free to ask me afterwards if you want to know more. So let me summarize what we have learned. I want to convey the idea that area law is universal in the theory of quantum gravity and is not restricted to entanglement or black hole entropies. It's a statement also for this generalized, more natural version of Rényi entropy, and that provides a generalization of the Rutakyanagi prescription. And also, all of this together with quantum information, very key concepts of quantum information, should really eventually push us towards the idea that we should think of entanglement as an ingredient that builds space-time. And this should help us eventually understand how space-time emerges from a non-gravitational CFT. In the near future, there are a few examples. I won't go through all of them, but I want to emphasize that the area law that I've mentioned for the Rényi entropy really provides a way of efficiently studying these Rényi entropies in strongly coupled systems. In particular, solving for a bulk geometry with cosmic brain is generally not more complicated than solving a PDE, and that's sort of the usual standard things that we solve for when we do ADS CFT calculations. In the long term, I'd like to emphasize that we really want to understand what kind of quantum field theories give rise to weakly coupled emergent gravitational duals, and if we can somehow extract their universal features, then we can use these lessons to eventually help us understand our universe, how to formulate gravity in our universe, which is expanding in an accelerating way. So I hope I have conveyed that all of this come together with cosmology also. So maybe instead of hearing, if we can solve all of this, then instead of hearing that we can do computations in the cloud, maybe someday we should be doing computation in the bulk or by using the black hole. Thank you.
Maybe a dumb question. Presumably, your formula also works for n smaller than one. Or
it certainly. I think in certain cases it works for n smaller than one. At least one example of that is you can immediately do spherical entangling surfaces, and that works for definitely for n smaller than one. I think it's worth checking whether in more general cases where we don't have a U1 symmetry, whether it works for n smaller than one. But for the spherical case, there is a conformal U1 symmetry, which is roughly speaking the boost in the causal diamond of the sphere of the disk. That allows that simplifies a lot of calculations. I believe that in general it should work even for n smaller than one. But in this derivation, at least, I don't think anything goes wrong. So I think it works. I think it works. In particular, in the example that I presented earlier. With a union of two disks, that's another example where you can go to smaller than one.
Are there any other questions?
I just wonder how do those Rényi entropies can fit in the recent proposed framework by Friedman and Hedrick with this
This is a very interesting question. I don't have a complete answer. Somehow the flow, so they were considering flows in the fixed background and then doing certain maximization and so on. Here, because the lesson that we have learned is that in terms of some surface, it has to back react and change the background as we compute different Rainy entropies for different values of n. So perhaps there is a way that we can think of the how the flows back reacts in some way to the geometry and then make it work. But I don't have a concrete way of reformulating the cosmic brain in terms of a flow in a simple way.
Well, let's thank you again.